Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Fill her up.
You're listening to the Gas Digital Network.
What is up, my fellow addicts? Ralph Sutton, the SDR Show this week. Hello to Steven Van Zandt. You may know him as Little Steven. Miami Steve, or even from The Sopranos, the dude's been around forever, and now he's on the SDR Show. Really cool guy, fun interview as well. Get into all different aspects of his career. Remember, we do this every Wednesday, every Saturday, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. We stream live at thesdrshow.com/live or gasdigitalnetwork.com, and you can watch for free. Just go ahead and check it out, 9 p.m. Eastern Time, every Wednesday, every Saturday. Or subscribe using the code SDR. You're going to get 20% off. You get HD, commercial-free, 5 days early, access to every episode we've ever done, and every show on the network, all with that SDR code at gasdigitalnetwork.com. But really, all we care about is spread the love, tell people about the show, get it out in the hands of other people, and then we keep growing, and that's what matters most. So here it is right now, the Steven Van Zandt episode of The SDR Show.
This is the intro to the shit show. Sex, drugs, and rock and roll. This is a hit show. Show me a tit show. Please, someone fuck the hoe. It's weed, I'm beat. It's hookers and blow. It's art, it's far. You need to know. The SDR Show. Let's go.
It is the SDR Show. Sex, drugs, and rock and roll show. I am Ralph Sutton. Back with me once again, it is James Madden. How are you, buddy?
Ralph, this is exciting. This is like December 25th and Super Bowl Sunday all rolled into one.
You're talking to a Jew that doesn't care about sports, so that's the wrong analogy for me, buddy. That really...
I guess only one of us is getting presents today, Ralph. Only one of us right here, this half-Gentile.
I'm going to try and do this justice because it's not easy to do when you have fucking rock and roll royalty on the line, but we'll try, okay? You may know him as Miami Steve. You may know him as Lil Steven. You may know him as Silvio Dante. You may know him as Frank Tagliano from Lilyhammer. Which also, by the way, first Netflix original program, which I did not know. Singer, songwriter, producer, actor, radio host, activist, and now just fucking Ed, author as well. Rock and Roll Hall of Famer, a true rock and roll rebel. And we're going to get into his new book, Unrequited Infatuations, Odyssey of a Rock and Roll Consigliere. I tried to say that as good as I can as a Jew. It is goddamn Steven Van Zandt. How are you, buddy?
I'm good. How's everybody?
In the world of radio, because you and I come from syndicated radio. You have a huge radio show. We'll get into that in a little bit as well. How do you feel my intro was, sir? You could be honest.
I think it was perfect. Absolutely perfect.
Thank you. Well, I want to say this. So I read the whole, I don't read books. I listen to books because I it's just easier for me to listen. And also when I see that it's the person actually doing the reading, I definitely want to listen. And I'll tell people, if the book doesn't hook you immediately when you hear about him hiding in a back seat on his way to political unrest, South Africa, if that doesn't hook you, listen, and not the great stories about the early days of Bruce or Asbury Jukes, put that on the side. You sold me when I've never heard such a passionate, emphatic plea to legalize prostitution. Kudos to you.
Well, we didn't want to make, you know, we didn't want to put too many politics into the book because, you know, I'm kind of known for the political stuff, but that's kind of a separate book, which I have half written. But I wanted to keep the politics to a minimum, but just to give a little flavor of, you know, flavor of what was going on.
Yeah, it was a pretty, by the way, it was like a pretty good plea for prostitution. I'm like, yeah, that should be legal everywhere. God damn it. Let's do this. Fuck Sun City. Let's do something like let's get laid in the city or something legal. I don't know. We can come up with something. But
work on that slogan there, Ralph. I'll work on the.
I'm not the lyricist there, but there is something to be there. I think so, Steve.
Well, you got, you know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll, as you say. You know, I mean, they all should be legal.
I mean, we have so many things to get to with you with so many years in this, but let's just start with the first question. What was the catalyst that in 2020 or whenever you started to actually write it, it came out last year, that you said, okay, I'm going to sit down. I'm going to write this book. Or maybe you had been piecing it together because you say in the book a few times you wrote it and you wish you had had a journal throughout the history of your life, and you didn't. So you're doing it from memory. What was that catalyst? Like, okay, fuck it. I'm doing this now.
Totally the quarantine. I was 100% responsible, honestly. I tried it like 10 years ago. I don't know, 15 years ago. I have no sense of time, you know. It just didn't feel right. And the two tours I did in 2017 and 19, reconnecting with my own music, which I had not done in 30 years, really helped me find a little closure. And it was suggested to me that maybe that's the best time now to write the book. And you know, with the quarantine, you know, you're stuck at home. It felt like, okay, you know, because I had toured and really was the most productive 3 years of my entire life these past 3 years before the quarantine, you know, it felt like, okay, I'm ready to do this now. I get an idea for the beginning, the middle, and an end, at least to that part of my life. So,
right. You know. I also like how the beginning and end, they kind of start as they're not first person, they're third person narratives, and then it switches to first person. That's just kind of a cool little twist to it that just gives you more of a almost like a movie like feel, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, that's what I wanted. That's what I wanted. I mean, I love third person, you know, books. I love biographies more than I do autobiographies, you know, for that reason. You know, but they wouldn't let me do the whole thing in third person. So I got the first and last chapters.
The book starts with obviously talking about the song that you became so synonymous with Sun City, and you're talking about that moment getting in there. But you talk in the book, and it's amazing to me that this had so much of an effect on you. Some German kid comes up to you and asks you, why are you putting missiles in my country? And that literally, that kid is the catalyst for you becoming the activist that you became. It's amazing to think if you didn't meet that kid, and did you ever try and track down that kid?
Yeah, that son of a bitch. I would have been so much happier, so much richer, you know, but you know, that's how it is. I was the least political guy in the world. I mean, I made it through the 60s without a single political thought in my head. And that was not easy. I mean, we had a lot going on in the 60s, man, you know, the beginning of civil rights and Vietnam and women's rights and you name it, you know, the assassinations and, there was a lot of political action in the 60s, and I just cruised right through it, man, totally focused on rock and roll. And I didn't wake up from that dream until we made it.
Right. You know?
And finally, with the River Tour, took us 5 albums to do it and 15 years of work, 15. And we finally broke through. And the tunnel vision kind of faded a little bit. And, I'm starting to look around and say, you know, what did I miss? You know, what's happening in the real world? And this kid says to me, you know, talking about the missiles. And I was like, what are you talking about? You know, I'm putting missiles in your country. But it wouldn't leave my head for like weeks. And I finally, you know, I'm a little bit slow. So it finally hit me. Like, holy shit, this kid doesn't look at me like a rock and roll guy or a Democrat or Republican. He sees me as an American, you know? And I'd never thought about, you know, that concept before that, oh my God, I'm an American, you know?
Right.
I mean, you just don't think like that in Jersey, you know? You know, it's just not, you know? And suddenly, you know, when you travel overseas, suddenly you realize how American you are. And I just wondered what obligations went with that. You know, what did that mean? What responsibilities did I have as an American citizen for the first time in my life? I never thought about it at all until I was 30.
Wow. Wow. I mean, you could say this goddamn Kraut loving rugrat made you leave Bruce Springsteen. That's another way to look at it. You know, I mean,
I wonder if you had the opposite on him. What if after talking to you, he went home and just got rid of political thoughts and joined like a German, like a glam metal band.
Yeah, he's now in Rammstein. He's the singer of Rammstein.
Yeah. I was thinking, it's like, you're right. I should just rock and bang everyone. This is crazy. Never watched a minute of news going forward.
Yeah, after that. Do you think this is I never like to talk politics personally because I feel, especially nowadays, you are polarizing yourself to half the country. To half the country is going to hate you when you take a stance. And you say over and over again in the book too, that, you know, you don't always make the best decisions. You make the decisions that feel right to you. So is there ever a time where you think maybe I shouldn't go on a, I've seen you do many anti-Trump tirades or on things like that, that, you know, are going to polarize people? Are you just at this point, who gives a shit? You're speaking your mind.
No, I don't give a fuck. I really don't, you know, I just feel like, we're in a war, you know, and we've been in a war, you know, we could talk about this all day, and I know you don't want to, but it goes all the way back to our founding, you know, right. The founding fathers that we all are so proud of, you know, there's only about 10 guys to be proud of, you know,
right.
All the rest of them were assholes, you know, the rest of them were white supremacist, you know, Christian extremists, you know, believers in an oligarchy. That's what the founding fathers were, except for a few guys that were a little bit more enlightened and planted those seeds that we're all still trying to live up to, you know, the freedom, you know, justice for all kind of stuff.
They don't teach that in school, that this, you know, this country was founded on people that were too religious for England. So they came here to be crazy religious. That doesn't really get taught in countries, in our country, because that's not a good narrative.
No. And now we have the Supreme Court, you know, who are, you know, these completely anti-American Christian extremists, you know, who are about to get rid of Roe v. Wade. But you know, anyway, where were we?
We don't want to go on a tirade on that. So let me bring it back to this. Like, so the thing that I found fascinating, because look, of course, I think it's against the law to not be a Bruce Springsteen fan in this country, especially if you're on the Northeast, right? So I've always been a fan, but not in listening to the book, I didn't realize how many years of trials and tribulations and startings and stoppings and thinking you're going to make it and still not making money and going back to working with the Asbury juice because there's no money in there. It's fucking years, as I'm 52. So to me, Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band was always just a huge fucking entity from when I'm old enough to remember. And it's not the case. It's great to hear that you guys put in that due diligence. That is probably why you guys are regarded as such a talented band. You spend so many years in venues. That doesn't happen anymore. That's a problem these days.
No, it's a big problem. It's a big problem. And not just for rock and roll, but the whole concept of development, you know, I mean, greatness, the concept of greatness, which is no longer part of our social narrative at all. Nobody's born great. Greatness is developed, greatness is earned, and greatness takes time.
Yeah.
And nobody has time anymore. And the biggest challenge for this young generation, and I talk about this all the time, because, you know, I do a lot of school visits, you know, because of my curriculum, you know. But, you know, the conversation always goes to, you guys have a big challenge, you know, shutting off that device, getting rid of all the distractions, and focusing on one craft, you know, that you're going to get good at, you know, because that doesn't change, man. Either you're good at that craft or you are not. And that takes development. You know, nobody's born great.
And it's also okay to put out a couple of, you know, albums that don't sell a million records or 5 million records. You could put out a few records to learn the art of writing music. Like you say it over and over again, you got better and better as you learned how to arrange, and you started being influenced by other things and you figure it out. That doesn't get to happen now. If your first album's not good, you're done.
Yeah, with a record company, that's true. I mean, they you know, they're all having trouble struggling now because there's no more sales.
Right.
So, I mean, the industry is really kind of over. But the only balance you can do right now is you get a chance to learn yourself. You know, you can do a lot of, you know, home recording and stuff that didn't exist when we were coming up.
Right.
So, you are able to sort of develop on your own that way. But you can only go so far on your own. You know, you really do need a few people, you know, collaborating to help you, you know, to mentor you a little bit. So it's a challenge, you know, for this generation. Yeah, a big one.
I like how you said one of the Bruce records, you guys spent $250,000. And nowadays with Wicked Cool Records, you could do 15 or 20 albums with that same amount of money, if not more. It's really wild but it's technology. And also you don't have the unlimited funds of a giant record company, you know?
No, it's amazing how we spent that money without even thinking about it. I swear to God, it was like, you know, what? I only have 200 grand, you know, that, you know, we make records for like $5,000, $10,000 now.
Yeah, I mean, right. Of course. You know, but it's also technology allows that too. It's not like it's just you are blowing the money. Technology allows that too.
Yeah. But it's also a lot of people are recording themselves. They're recording all the instruments, you know. Right. So a lot of musicians are having trouble, you know, struggling to survive. And
James has a guitar with him right now. James, you want to show me your guitar?
No, I have a guitar lately, which when I say that word, Stephen, Ralph loses his mind. He's offended that it even exists. I got this so I can go on the road because I'm always better when I play a little before I do stand up. So when I'm on the road, I'm not going to bring a guitar. And then everyone's like, oh, you have a gig? Yeah. Where are you playing guitar? Well, I'm a co- so it's just tough. So I have this and it's the greatest thing ever. And I usually play while I wait for them to get on the Zoom. And then he judges me, Stephen. He judges me.
Stephen, tell the truth. He looks a little effeminate holding a guitar lately. Come on now.
There's nothing wrong with it. Yo, but I shred on this shit, man. I play a bunch of Sex Pistol covers. Come on, dog. You ain't going to do nothing with that, Ralph.
Well, I was going more towards 1963 Gordon Lightfoot, but you know.
Okay. Well,
that,
we
that
will,
also works.
Let's
That's
agree
gonna be my next tattoo, Gordon Lightfoot, right here, man.
So, what's interesting also is in reading the book, and I know James has a bunch of questions. I'm going to shut up in a minute, but we have the first half of the book really is about you know working your way through with Bruce and getting bigger and bigger and blah blah blah, but then about halfway through the book, there's a paradigm shift, so to speak, where it's more about you searching for your identity and trying to figure out your path of who is little Steven. And that is a wild switcheroo that happens about halfway through the book.
Yeah, I think that's when things become a little bit more universal. You know, the first half, it's a good story. You know, local kid makes it to the top of rock and roll. I mean, nothing wrong with that. But the second half, as you suggest, suddenly I not only leave the job of the E Street Band, I ended my life as far as I knew.
Right.
There was no plan B after that. So now it becomes a little bit more universal because I think everybody hits that wall sooner or later in their life. And maybe that first dream doesn't work out, or the first job, whatever, you know, and then, you know, you're kind of on your own for a minute, and it becomes a search for identity, a search for, you know, purpose in life, a search for enlightenment or whatever you want to call it. And what's interesting to me, I think what, you know, and what became clear to me after I read, after I wrote the book, was that everything I've accomplished really happened after I thought my life was over.
Right.
Know?
I mean, especially the things that you're known for so much. Like, I was going to ask you that was, it's funny, I was telling the staff here, I was telling them two before you came on, the chair I'm sitting in this morning, right? And I don't mean to be crass, but I think in listening to your book, you can handle it. I had sex in this chair this morning, right? It was great. And the girl, I told her, I'm interviewing Stevie Van Zandt. And I said, oh, from, you know, from E Street Band and, you know, a bunch of other stuff. And she goes, oh, I, you know, she's 25. She doesn't know, right? But then she sees the picture.
Boy, what a flex. Goes, oh, what a humble brag. You know, she's 25, this kid. Okay. All right, big shot. Okay.
Keep your mouth shut, guitar lady. So she sees the picture of you and she goes, oh, Silvio from fucking Soprano. So my question is, at this point, who do you get recognized as more? Do you get recognized as Frank, as Silvio, as little Steven? Like, who would, then I'm sure there's a bunch of people that don't even know you're in a band or play guitar.
Yeah, it depends what's going on. It depends what, you know, what country you're in. I mean, it depends, you know, if we're touring with the E Street Band, of course, and right. you're in a, you know, you're in Rome.
I'm saying like you're at a restaurant or whatever. What's more common?
It's I gotta say I give the edge to Silvio and Sopranos. I think that's probably a little bit more response these days than E Street or, you know, Lilyhammer. People discovered really more during the quarantine because we were the first show on Netflix and people didn't know what Netflix was.
Yeah, it's pretty wild. And then it won a bunch of awards as well too, which is crazy. I love the story that David Chase, who was the creator of Sopranos, by the way, you're our third soprano on the show. We had Michael, we had a Big Pussy who fucking hated me. We'll say that again. He did not like me. And now we have you. Well, Michael said that he just hates everybody. And it was three Italians and me. I'm a Jew from Brooklyn. He just didn't like me from the get-go. But what are you going to do? But David actually reached out to you, and you're not at least at the time, not an actor. You were going to be Tony. That was be a digital audition. And then you're like, nah, that doesn't make any sense. And you're basically, correct me if I'm wrong, because feel free, I'm wrong all the time. You're kind of playing a version of yourself. And what I mean by that is, a guy that doesn't want to be in the front, that works in the back, that handles things is the guy that you go to for problems, and it's the guy that the main person trusts. So you're kind of, in a way, playing a version of you.
It kind of it developed into that, yes. But it wasn't really planned that way, oddly enough. Mm-hmm. I think what's interesting to me, and I don't even think this is in the book, but when I think back on it, here's David Chase, who's Mr. Detail, Mr. Authenticity. You know, I mean, you know, nobody loves Sopranos more than the real mob guys. You know, they loved it. And he did not have a role for the underboss, you know, for the consigliere, you know, and sometimes they're two different guys, sometimes it's the same guy. But for some weird reason, he never wrote in a part for that. So at first I was just going to front the, you know, fronting the strip club for the family. Mm-hmm. And we had our meetings in the back, you know, and my role was a little bit unclear because he had thought of me at first as to play Tony Soprano, you know, and HBO said, "Are you out of your fucking mind? You know, this guy never acted in his life. You know, this is our biggest investment ever." You know, and so I ended up, you know, he asked me what kind of part would I like to play, and I said, you know, I'll tell you the truth, I'm starting to feel a little guilty about taking an actor's job. Huh. You know,
something that involves boobies, please.
What's that?
You said something that involves boobies, please.
Oh, no, I wasn't that intelligent. I just he said, "What do you want to do?" And I said, "I'm feeling a little guilty." So he says, "Okay, you're not going to take an actor's job. I will write you in a part that doesn't exist. And what do you want to do?" I had a couple of treatments at that point. It wasn't a script yet. It's a script now. About this guy, Silvio Dante, an independent hitman, you know, and he had like a Copacabana type of club and like that. And Chase was like, "That's interesting." And came back a couple of days later, said, "HBO can't afford it. We'll make it a strip club," you know? So I became the front of the strip club. Mm-hmm. But then as that first season just developed, you know, I just ended up evolving into that consigliere role. Maybe they picked up on me and Jimmy, you know, getting along very, very well right from the beginning, which was very important to me. I wasn't sure how the actors were gonna, what kind of an attitude they were gonna have right. about me, you know. But they knew I was taking it seriously, and Jimmy treated me with respect right away. So when the main guy treats right. you with respect, it trickles down, you know. And you know, they saw us getting along, and maybe they picked up on that. I don't know, but by the end of the first season, I had pretty much moved into that position of the underboss.
You know, what's funny, by the way, is that I was a strip club DJ in New Jersey at a place called Lace in Wayne, New Jersey, and the Sopranos production company came to Lace first and said, "We need Sunday nights. It's going to be like, you know, once a month or something. They're going to film on Sunday nights." And the owner of my club said, "Absolutely not." And then they just went, you know, 5 minutes away to Satin Dolls. And that became bada bing. Boy, did they fuck themselves by doing that.
Bueno.
It really was so stupid. They didn't want to close one night a month or something for the Sopranos, because they didn't know at the time. They didn't know.
Yeah. Nobody knew.
All right. Before we go any further, if you are a fan of the show, you know already all about Delta 8. What is Delta 8? It's something that is found in weed and can legally be shipped nationwide, and most importantly, gets you high through the fine people of Yo Kratom. They have created Yo Delta. Yo Delta sponsors not just us, but a bunch of shows on the network, and they can keep you high all summer long. Just go to yodelta.com. They have gummies, they have vapes, they have everything you need to get yourself high throughout the summer of 2022. You go to yourdelta.com and use the promo code GASH. You're going to get 25% off. That's 25% off your entire order just for using the promo code GAS. That's GAS at yourdelta.com. A majority of the states that we are living in these United States, it is legal to ship Delta 8. So hopefully you're in one of those states. And if you are, it is time to stock up on all that Delta 8. So go to yodelta.com, use the code GAS, get 25% off, and let's get back into it right now.
And then what's funny, one more interesting thing. So I did syndicated rock radio for 15 years, right? I had a show that started in 2000 and it was on all over the country, but boy, did we lose every time Little Steven's Underground Garage came on that channel. Well, on that station, we got dropped right quick. So congratulations. You're such a successful show. Who knew that, you know, you look at your career. Yes, you know, musically have been in very influential in various ways from, you know, not only Bruce Springsteen, but, you know, Southside Johnny and the Asbury Dukes, your solo career, all that other stuff. And then, you know, Sun City, whatnot. But then you're in Sopranos. You're now let's add Underground Garage. Let's add them one of the longest running like syndicated radio shows. It's wild how many different things you do that are still that are just so influential. It's wild.
Yeah, I'm proud of that. I'm very proud of that. I just, you know, you turn the radio on one day and you realize, wait a minute, you know, a whole lot of great music isn't being played anymore. And I think this is before Sirius Satellite started. So, you know, you really were on your own with strictly the regular radio. Mm-hmm. And I just was like, man, it's a whole generation of kids or two or three generations are not going to hear the greatest music ever made, you know, and all due respect to the mainstream, you know, classic rock stations, which are all my stations, mm-hmm. you know, but they're playing a certain genre, you know, they're playing 300-500 records, you know,
if you're lucky, that many.
Yeah. But they're great records, you know, there are records, you know, but I'm like, well, what about the rest? You know? So my playlist, I think is like 6,000 songs.
Wow.
And I handpicked every one of them and it goes back all the way to like 1951. And we've introduced over 1,000 new bands in 20 years.
So wow, that's a nice thing to say. And then also you and I share a mutual love for radio consultants, which is awesome. It's nice to know that we both like them equally the same, I feel.
Well, you know, they've asked me to speak at those conventions, believe it or not, you know, the fools that they are, you know.
And I would
tell them, you know, what are you so afraid of playing new music for? You know, you'll play the Beatles all day, but if Paul McCartney puts out a new record, you won't play it.
That's insane.
You know, Rolling Stones, you know, you play them all day, new record, you won't play it. I mean, it's the same, they sound the same, you know, they haven't changed in 50 years. I mean, what do you think your audience is going to do? Run for the station, run for the radio and change the station? I mean, you know, I tried to convince them that, you know, by playing new things, it keeps the older things relevant.
Of course. You know, believe me, you and I had the same argument with them for fucking years, but you're Little Steven. I'm just some idiot. So I never won those arguments, but it's just nice to know that you were out there fighting the good fight. I once had to listen to a 45-minute dissertation from McVeigh Media, which is one of the big consultants, on why you should play a hit out of the commercials and not a B track or a C track. It has to be an A track. Because you're rewarding them for sticking through the commercial break. I was like, shut the fuck up. It was horrible. Oh, my God. I'm sorry, James. I know you have a bunch of questions.
I was wondering when you told them that and listening, did they know that you just had sex with a 25-year-old on that chair? I'm sure that would have changed everything.
I'm going to send the clip to them to let them know now, James. By the way, is it really true? Is it really true that your name, Miami Steve, came because you were the only dude that went to Miami? Or is that not true?
No, that's true.
Wow.
You know, nobody left town in those days. He didn't leave town.
Steven is so worldly. He's been to Miami.
And he's wearing Hawaiian stuff in the winter in New Jersey. You're going to stick out a little there, baby.
Yeah, it's true. I know it sounds silly, but it's true. And, you know, we all have nicknames and that became my first.
Is there a nickname that you identify? Like, do you prefer your full real name, Little Steven or Miami Steve, or you don't have an affinity towards any one of them?
No, I don't give a shit, really. You know, I really don't care. You know, I mean, I've had a million names. I like, you know, I've always had a bit of a contradiction. You know, it's a bit of a paradox with, you know, I don't mind being known, you know, but I'm not crazy about being too well known, mm-hmm. you know. So I don't mind.
Then you would love my career, I'll tell you that.
I like changing names every now and then, you know, and... just keeping it, you know, being a moving target, you know.
Hypothetically, Steve, if this was possible, if Little Steven and Miami Steve could be in a room and they had a dispute and they got in a fight, who'd be the winner? It's my favorite hypothetical I've done in a while, baby. I would say in DraftKings, Miami Steve minus 250.
I would tell you why. I have my reasons why it would be Miami Steve, but let's see what he says. Do you have an answer for that? I have a logical answer. Here's a logical answer. You were Miami Steve younger. So younger Miami Steve would be stronger and more scrappy. Little Steven came later on.
But he put on a little more like muscle to play Silvio, right? So I would say little Steven might be sneaky. So if you want to take the plus 250, you might be doing okay.
I don't know.
But the question is just too stupid to answer.
It was fun to goddamn ask, Steven.
James opens his mouth once and he asks an idiotic question. Go
should
back
I,
to your
should
ukulele.
I just play a guitar lately? I'll just play it right now. Come on. I'll play Glory Days. What about, let's see. Can I do another stupid one or no?
Come on, bring it.
What is the foreheads, the Mount Rushmore of the great Garden State of New Jersey? If you all time, the four to represent.
Musicians or all things?
Any human being who is would be New Jersey. I mean, if you're born there and you leave Trenton at two to live in goddamn Springfield, Massachusetts, you're out.
I mean, number one's got to be the situation.
Now, turn on him. Turn on him now, Steve. Turn on him.
Oh, man, that's a good question, huh?
Boy, when you're back.
I mean, Frank Sinatra comes to mind immediately. I think Count Basie. I think
I just played his theater, baby. Boom, boom, boom.
Frankie Valli.
Frankie Valli. He's got to be there.
You know, I'm trying to think of some other areas of
You stumped him. You broke Steven.
What about Bruce?
I'll put Bruce there. Yeah, he could be the fourth.
Does that mean we have to cut down the situation now? He can't be in there. So now, also, by the way, Steve, as you know, I got
you
to see
it to the top eight Mount Rushmore.
I never got to see you guys at the Stone Pony, right? But I've been to the Stone Pony a plethora of times. I actually got to see Bon Jovi did a secret show there once when they were already megastars. They did like a private show there, which was I got to see. And I've been there. I hosted a show, Living Color, there once. It's such a legendary venue. Had no idea that basically I have you to thank for it even still existing because it was about to go under and you guys decided to help revive it. I had no idea. I always knew that, you know, Bruce Springsteen and Asbury Jukes are synonymous with Stone Pony, but not so much that you made it stay alive.
Yeah, it wasn't out of being nice guys. We had quite a struggle going from the rock world is basically three sort of stages. You're the teenage years, which is the most fun, is you know what's that's what I enjoyed most in the book writing, and then the bar band years. And then the industry, if you get into the business, right? Well, we had a tough time going from, you know, the teenage years into the bar band years because we went from having complete freedom. And that was the fun part about being a teenager back then. The adults wouldn't even consider trying to tell you what to do because they had no idea what you were doing. No idea, you know? You wanted something to do with rock and roll, you had to get a 15-year-old kid. You know, like it's kind of like what's going on now in a way. But anyway, then you get into the bar band world and it's nothing but rules. It's all rules. You know, you got to play the top 40, you got to wear suits. You got to have this choreography. You know, I mean, there was a whole lot of rules that we needed to break in order to break in because we had been thrown out of a lot of bars. We had been, you know, we lost a lot of jobs. Because they were going to close, we just said, listen, you're going to close in 2 weeks anyway, whatever it was, a month. We're going to play whatever we want, but we won't charge you anything. We'll just take the door and you take the bar and we'll, you know, and you close the place, you know. And so that was the only way we were able to have that kind of freedom in the bar band world. And we really did revolutionize that whole world.
Yeah, pretty wild. And then, by the way, that became the norm for so many of us that worked in club space, which I did when I was younger, where all right, we take the door, you take the bar. That really wasn't done before then. That was just a unique way to do it, you know, because I became a rock club promoter in the like late 80s, early 90s. And that was like the standard that didn't exist before that, you guys doing that, which is pretty wild. One of the things I really love is you talk about how the Beatles, when they played Ed Sullivan, there was no bands in New York or in the country. Then there was 5,000 the next day. The quote I love is the Beatles introduced us to rock and the Rolling Stones invited us in. It's just a great, accurate quote. But what's so nice is the book kind of not starts, but gets into the beginning, how influential the Beatles and Paul McCartney and all them were for you. And at the end of the book, not only, I mean, you playing with Paul, but not like you joining him. He joins your band on stage. What a great button at the end of it, which is a great story and gives you validity and validation in your world. But in listening to this, you play with everybody that you seem to be your heroes. You brought them in for albums and all that great stuff. Was there anybody you weren't able to get for whatever reason, like someone you sought after for years, but somehow not someone that died, because that obviously wasn't going to happen, but somebody you were after for years that for whatever reason didn't happen?
We mean as a producer, you mean? Or,
as in any capacity, as in sharing the stage with, becoming friends with, just somebody that you've always wanted to work with when in any capacity just didn't happen. Because in reading the book, it seems like you fucking got to meet everybody you ever wanted to work with.
Well, early on, and I explained why, I never wanted to meet any of my heroes, because of a bad incident I had.
Well, the autograph incident, we'll call it. Yeah,
with Freddie King. And then, ironically, I ended up doing Sun City and producing 50 of my favorite artists. I mean, that was one extreme to the other. And, I was always very nervous about that because, if you meet your hero and they're an asshole, you can't listen to the music the same way again.
Right.
I can't. So I was, a little nervous about the whole Sun City experience, but I was so obsessed with the politics that I just said, fuck it, I got to do this. But it was, very rewarding when somebody as tough and nobody was ever tougher than Miles Davis walks in, and he was respectful. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. He was like, the nicest guy in the world, which, he could be very tough.
To be. Yeah.
And he didn't do any of those things. He didn't do any charity things ever. He was really, really, really into the South Africa thing. And I just happened to hit the right thing, happened to know the sound man that was my old sound man working for him and just connecting. And he walked in, man. And it was like, whoa. This is one of the thrills of my life. And, there I am producing Miles Davis,
That's wild. It's also, you said a story which is so crazy to think about because of the modern day with internet and stuff, that you had to show senators where fucking South Africa was. Some of them didn't know.
Yeah. I think it's one of the reasons why we succeeded in a funny way. We kind of snuck up on everybody. And the issue, it wasn't like it was a lost issue. It was a non-issue. It was just not even an issue. And so, we kind of caught everybody by surprise. And we had to do a lot of work to raise the consciousness about it, which is what it was all about. It wasn't a money thing for us. We knew there was going to be an economic sanctions bill eventually. And we had to raise the consciousness enough to make sure that Reagan didn't veto it, which he did, and we had enough strength in the country by then, consciousness wise, to actually override a Reagan veto for the first time.
Yeah, it's so wild.
Yeah, it was a big move, and so we were able to do that. Kind of got lucky in a number of ways. I mean, radio wouldn't play it, so MTV. Mm-hmm. I met with MTV. I said, I heard you got a problem with black people.
Good opening line. Just go right for the jump.
I mean, this was like 84, whatever it was, 84, 85. And I said, I got more black people in this video than you're ever going to play the rest of your life. So, do yourself a favor here. I mean, this is the right thing for a change.
Right.
Instead of chasing it afterwards, saying we supported it afterwards, get in early on this one,
right.
And it's you know, it's not just a black issue, of course. Anytime there's a racial issue, it's gonna be a more than one race problem, obviously, you know, but it was something that we needed to do, you know, to just by doing the right thing. And MTV thankfully really adopted it, and BET, you know, and the Black Entertainment Network also. But that's the only way people heard that song, because it was never on the radio.
Do you also notice the parallels nowadays with China and the Middle East, where there are these countries that have so many sanctions, but there's so much money there that bands are playing anyway, just like Sun City, where they're going to, like, there's that new golf thing that just started in Saudi Arabia, or the China, where they're editing things and having issues there, but everyone's looking the other way because there's so much fucking money there. It's very similar to what was happening then.
Yeah, it is, you know, it's pretty complicated. You know, it's not easy to just say, well, you know, the golfers are wrong, you know, because I mean, it feels exactly like Sun City, where, you know, the bad guys are overpaying, you know,
To get
people in and get the endorsement.
We need another song, you know, is what I'm saying, Stevie. We need another song.
Well, you know, but the problem is with the golfers, you know, here we are, we're doing business with Saudi Arabia, you know, we're selling them weapons, you know, they got to be top three in terms of selling weapons.
Oh yeah, no,
right?
I agree. It's a complicated issue, but as you said in the book, you're good at looking at these issues and figuring out how do we fucking solve it. So maybe we need you on the case, is what I'm saying.
I'm gonna start writing a song, Stephen, on the guitar lately. We ain't gonna putt on the LIV. That's what we're gonna do.
I mean, it's also wild. Again, I think we're getting a little political, but how do we not with little Stephen? Any country that has Sharia law, it boggles my mind that there's girls that do Instagram chats from there. It's like, hey, I can't go outside on my own, but here's a picture of me in a pool. It's crazy. It's wild.
I know. That's why I was so pissed off about Afghanistan. But let's not go into it,
sorry,
I guess.
It's just too easy to go down that road. Sorry about it.
I know. But, I just don't believe in those. You know, you can turn your head to a degree, but it's hard to be consistent these days is the bottom line, you know, and that's why it's hard to criticize the golfers completely. You know, somebody offers you $200 million. What are you going
to
do?
Anything you ask me to, I'll do it right now. Exactly. Whatever it is. I'm going to kill Shannon. I'll kill Shannon. I don't give a shit.
If you win 10, you know, 10 events on the PGA, I mean, what is that? Maybe 20 million, you know, if you happen to win 10, you know, in a year, which is impossible, you know, if you're lucky, you're going to win 3 or 4, right? You know, and what do they pay? Two or three million an event, right? Something like that. So,
and
you know,
it's events million. The same time. Yeah.
You're talking to a man who's never held a golf club. Is it a golf club? Yeah, that's what it's called. I have no barometer.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
To bring it back around, what I like, I watched a little video of you and Bruce talking about your book. It was somewhere, I think it was in Asbury Park. It was called Between the Lines. Am I saying that right? I might be wrong, but that, and I could be wrong, but it was you and Bruce on stage, just kind of taking questions and talking. It's amazing to think, I think, I forget how old you are, but you're early 70s. Am I wrong? I think you are, right? Something like that. And you met in like 15 or something. To still be friends with someone basically 60 years later through all these trials and tribulations, it's a beautiful thing. It's wild to see. It really is amazing.
Yes, I agree.
It really is wild. It really is. James, I have a few other topics that are off music, but I know you have some music questions, James. So before I go into these off music questions, go ahead.
Well, I actually was going to go Sopranos with the next one, but
go ahead. Go for it.
Okay. What is your favorite episode of all time? Because my buddies and I, anytime anyone's sad, we just text the other guy, watch The Happy Wanderer. Or we'll just call it The Executive Game, in which you're absolutely spectacular, where you start making crumbs all over the place with the Balawakwa kid. It cheers. I get depressed every Father's Day, and I watch it every Father's Day to get better. And I leave the house with a huge smile every time. But like, what is your favorite?
That's nice. I don't know the names of them, but I know I've never watched the show from the beginning, which I got to do one of these days. I enjoyed the scenes with Jimmy when I had to bring him bad news, you know, and he would get mad at me. And it was something that was, I knew about that dynamic, you know, how that works. When you're the only guy who can bring the bad news to the boss because you're the only guy that's not afraid of him, you know, you're going to get a lot of heat, but you got it. That's part of being a friend, you know? And then the other things I enjoyed also, the one arc that where Jimmy's in the hospital and I'm doing the scenes with my wife for the first time, because, you know, she's the real actor in the family. And most of the time she was with the girls, I was with the guys, you know. We had very few scenes, you know, where we were together, except for that one couple of shows when Jimmy's in the hospital, you know, Tony's in the hospital. And those were very enjoyable too.
By the way, I'm going to tell you what I told both Michael Imperioli and Big Pussy, which is maybe why they didn't like me. Well, Michael and I are friends, but I've never seen an episode of The Sopranos. It's kind of weird. I just never saw it, which is bizarre, but I know it's a good show. Michael's response was, you should check it out. People seem to like it, which is a great response. One day I will sit down. I just want to, it's so much television right now. It's hard to do.
I've watched it three times start to finish since February of 2020.
Oh my God. I know there's a scene. Isn't there a scene where you strangle
Radio Mod?
Yeah, I heard that was a pretty powerful scene. But now I'm going to move into some other things. So number one, a new thing that I saw you're doing is the Little Steven Underground Apothecary. You're selling weed these days. Is that a new project?
Well, yes, it's relatively new. We had the apothecary started. We were doing some teas. Again, it was, you know, COVID related kind of. We were doing some teas and lollipops with special herbs to strengthen the immune system, you know, figuring that, you know, that's part of our problem in this country. Our immune system is like shit because of all the shit we eat. And then we started moving into some Stevie weed, you know, right now it's just in one state. I think it's just in Massachusetts, but we're making some moves to expand that. Yeah.
That's cool. And then I know another thing that you're very passionate about is in the education world. I've watched you talking about turning STEM into STEAM, adding arts into the curriculum across the board. And I know you're a big advocate for all that. Are you working with schools? Like how are you making that happen?
Yeah, we started promoting it. You know, we worked on it for 15 years and finally started going public with it on the Soulfire tour in 2017. And we put aside 500 tickets for teachers for free. Invited 500 teachers. And then we would do a seminar in between a sound check and a show to explain to them the curriculum. Because you have to kind of teach the teachers how to teach it a little bit. But it's free online, teachrock.org. And we now have 50,000 teachers.
Wow.
We have over 100 partner schools who have adopted it. The entire state of Connecticut has adopted it. It's really been quite successful, even though it's just getting started. The teachers just love it. It's a way of connecting to this generation of kids, which nobody seems to be adjusting to. It's a whole new ball game, you know, in the education world, of getting these kids' attention and keeping it, because they're smarter than us, they're faster than us, and they have absolutely no patience, you know.
Right. Talked about in the book about how you were like the first generation that grew up with rock as like a thing, because rock was so new. The new generation, they grew up where the internet and iPhones, everything, but always already been a thing where they didn't have to learn it. It's just part of the zeitgeist of being a child now, you know? Right. So they're going to assimilate things very differently than any of us would have.
Very, very different. I mean, I never thought our generation gap could be beat, but this one's very close because it's much more subtle. You know, I mean, we were at war with our parents, you know, and we embarrassed our parents and it was a terrible time. Now, I mean, you know, kids live with their parents till they're 45. So it's a little bit more subtle. But their brains are different. And I swear someday, I think science will prove that these kids' brains are being transformed by the technology. Because
I'm sure.
I'm not kidding. I mean, you hand your phone to a 7-year-old and they're gonna solve the problem for you.
You've seen little children trying to make the screen bigger. You know, they're too young to even know what they're doing, but they're doing that. When you added the A to Steam, was there a second where you thought maybe we should call it Meats? Same letters, Steam and Meats, same letters. I just figured that out live. I did a little anagram for everybody playing at home, a live anagram. Not to tell you to do your business, but how come there is no Little Stevie line of fucking scarves? How come that doesn't exist? The hat scarves, how come that doesn't exist?
Well, you know what? We we did. I'm not sure this is in the book either, but they I had an idea years ago, many years ago, and McDonald's adopted the kids at Ronald McDonald House. You mm-hmm. know, they get for cancer. You know, they got to wear these scarves. You know when the hair goes. And I thought, let's do a line of scarves for the kids, and make them rock stars instead of being self conscious about it. Right. Let them be proud of wearing the scarves. And we did that for a while. I thought they were going to adopt it nationally. It never happened nationally. But they did it in New York. They made me the ambassador of Ronald McDonald House.
Oh wow! But of the headgear that you wear, and you talk about it in the book, do you have a supplier specifically now? Someone that designs them for you, or no?
No. I just have my sister-in-law. She's a designer.
Oh, okay. Because I'm telling you, I think it would sell. That's all I'm saying. I think it would sell.
Yeah, maybe so, but I'm allergic to money anyway. So
I know you've definitely.
It's the greatest quote in the book.
That's probably the good theme of the book is money made and money lost. There's really definitely a general vibe of the book. All right, Shannon, we don't have much time left with this man, so we're going to do the first now.
The first time ever I saw concert Detroit.
The name of the show is the SDR Show, Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll Show. We ask every guest this since the dawn of time about their first experience with all three. I kind of know some of the answers, but I'm going to shut my mouth because they are addressed in the book. But we start with rock and roll. The first concert you ever went to?
Little Anthony Imperials at the, was it the Tom's River or the Bricktown roller drome,
right.
A roller skating rink.
That's pretty wild.
Roller skating rinks were a very regular venue.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. I used to go to the one in Brooklyn called the Roller Palace when I was a kid.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then soon after that, was the Rascals at another rolling.
That's really wild. Skater. You guys want to hear something really embarrassing? I was in a breakdancing contest at a roller skating rink when I was 13 years old, and we came in second.
Oh,
wow.
And the reason why we lost. They brought an 8-year-old kid out to do some moves, and that's why they beat us. We were better. They used the kid. Really pissed me off. All right, now, drugs. You kind of talk about this in the book, but after weed, the first drug you did after weed. Unless weed after, was after weed, after pot, because everyone's first drug almost always is pot.
Oh. Well, messing around with the other, hashish, that kind of thing. But I did about, I want to say, I think I did 3 trips with LSD in those days, which I know people find it's hard to believe, but we were not doing drugs to escape or to entertain ourselves. We were actually looking for enlightenment and thought that was the shortcut to it. Mm-hmm. I think in the book I called LSD the hippie internet. we couldn't find out about Eastern philosophy or right. It was all everything was a mystery, and
LSD, they didn't know South Africa was a country. Everything was a fucking mystery.
Yeah
Maybe he knew because he took the acid. If those senators would have, they would have known what the hell was going on. You think Strom Thurman fucking was dropping LSD?
Yeah, I doubt it. And now the first time you had sex, you kind of talk about this in the book too, but the first time you had sex.
Yeah, yeah. Successfully was with my...
was 2 girlfriend. Years ago.
On a chair, Ralph. You guys can relate.
Yeah. Wait a minute. It was that chair. Right there.
Right there.
Yeah, it was, you know, my high school girlfriend, and you know, I had been kicked out of school and kicked out of the house. So I was living with my girlfriend at the time because, you know, her mother worked during the day, and you know, so you know, it worked out. Worked out well.
From what I understand in the book, you kind of mentioned, I think it was in her mother's bed. Am I right with that? Isn't that right?
Yeah. We you know, she had, the mother had the bigger bed, and right. So
and yeah, probably probably the bigger cans too, but still.
Good old Ralph. Bookend it the right way, baby. That's how Ralph do, Steve.
Yeah, that's how I do.
That's how he do.
The last one, of course, are you still, the Rock and Roll Forever Foundation is something you worked with for years. Is that still active?
Yeah, the Rock, it's now called the Rock and Soul Forever Foundation. It's the parent of teachrock.org.
Okay,
so that's the... that's the foundation. Teachrock.org is the first program of the foundation. Yeah.
All right, and now this is the last, it's a stupid question, but you know, you've done so much. When you look at now, you know, we'll add best-selling author. We'll, you know, music, we got music covered. We got acting covered. Like, you produce things, you've written songs for other people like fucking Pearl Jam, all the shit, whatever. What is on little Steven's list that says, well, this is the last thing I really would like to do in my, because you're always, you talk about how you always have ideas. You did that wild thing that you never got off the ground with your wife, which was like impressionist art mixed with music, all these different things that you worked on. But there's got to be something now. They're like, this is a different path for me that I'd like to try before I can't.
I don't know. I mean, I tell you the truth.
But add radio programmer and radio host to that list of things. I'm sorry. So continue.
Yeah, no, I've been having a little trouble with this myself, you know, deciding, you know, what exactly I'd like to do next. My favorite thing I've ever done, and I talked about it in the book, and I've only done it once, really, was our Broadway show. Mm-hmm. Me and Maureen and a guy named Mark Brickman put on Broadway, you know, and that's my favorite thing is when all of the arts come together. So that's why I love TV also. You know, and I got 25 treatments for TV shows, mm-hmm. 5 of them completed scripts. So I'm hoping to get back on TV for sure. But there's nothing quite like a live event. You know, the Broadway experience really blew my mind. I got to say, mm-hmm. I really understood the theater thing for the first time. When you know, when people are laughing to something you wrote, or you know, mm-hmm. they're enjoying,
and that,
you know,
immediate reaction of it, that immediacy of it, which is also
and it's all the, you know, you get the you know, the choreography, the wardrobe, you know, the sets, you know, the music, the mm-hmm. lyrics, you know, all this, all of the arts come together. And I think, you know, if I, you know, next life, you know, I want to, you know, I want to come back as a Diaghilev or a Bob Fosse, or, you know, that's where what I like the most.
And if you have some extra time on your hands, maybe give James Mattern some shillelagh lessons.
Shillelagh? Is that what it is now? Shillelagh?
What's it called? The ukulele? What is it called?
Shillelagh was like a character on Martin's TV show.
I don't know. What is it called? Ukulele?
Guitar-lele. It's a ukulele with 2 extra strings. The top, the low string is an A. It's like playing with a capo on the third. Whatever.
The book is called
Amoeba Music Sticker.
This is going to be a shitty thing, but as a man with that gets shit on very often for a somewhat large vocabulary, your book, I appreciate it because you do not dumb down. You do use big words in the book, and even the title, Unrequited Infatuation, is not a rock star title. It's a thinking man's title. You know, so I appreciate that. The new book, which came out in September, I believe, is out. Unrequited Infatuation, Odyssey of a Rock and Roll Consigliere. Great book. Really get the audio book because you even do, like, you don't, I don't think you realize it, but like when you're talking, like as Bruce quotes, you kind of talk a little bit like Bruce. When you talk about, use their inflections a little bit. I'm very auditory based. So it's worth listening to. Get the book. Follow you at Stevie Van Zandt on Instagram, littlesteven.com. Is there anything else you want to plug before we wrap this up?
I got no agenda today. Nothing.
Nothing. All right, James, your plugs.
All right, James Mattern on Instagram and my YouTube channel. Yo, man, we just put out James Madden, the Check Spot on YouTube. It is the my love letter to the worst part of the comedy show, the Check Spot, when everyone pays their bills and doesn't pay attention. I have two full sets of me in black and white, like Jim goddamn Jarmusch directed it. There's interviews. It's a quasi-documentary. The responses have been great. The album version was album of the year. So check this out. I'm very proud of it. I bet I'm – it's crazy re-listening to your audiobook, Steve. I related because you bet on yourself and just went where you felt like you had to, and you lost some – I lost some money on this too, but it was worth it because you have to chase what's inside you. So please, everybody, the Check Spot, James Madden, the Check Spot on YouTube, share it. Let everyone know because I'm very proud of this goddamn thing.
And maybe shorten your plugs next time we have a legend on the line. Shannon, your plugs.
You can follow me.
I'm going to play him next time.
You can follow me on Instagram at ShannonLee6982 and listen to my podcast, The Thing Is Ding. We talk about bad dates, fighting, and ghosts. We have all sorts of interesting guests come on, comedians, musicians, reality TV stars, porn stars, and they tell their own personal stories about a bad date that they've been on, a time they got into a street fight, and an experience with the paranormal.
Okay, now, Stevie, this is the last question of the show. We don't want you to give any indication. Don't even smile or react.
No
the
poker.
Question we're going to go around the room and ask, does Stevie Van Zandt, Miami Steve, Little Steven, believe in ghosts? James, what is your thought?
I want to I think logically it's no, but I think there's a chance that maybe he has a story that he didn't put in the book of like talking to John Lee Hooker or something. So I'm on the fence.
No indication. Shannon, yours?
I'm going to go no, though. I'm going no.
I'll say Shannon? Yes.
I'm saying Italian guy from Jersey, fucking 100% yes. But let's see what he says. Do you believe in ghosts, Steve?
Yes.
All right, there was no doubt in my mind.
Fuck, I haven't won in a while. God damn it!
We had an incident in the New Orleans hotel that convinced me.
Was it with the band? Was it with your wife?
Yep. Yeah, it was on tour. Yes. My wife. My wife was in the room, things turned off and on. The chairs flew back. My wife was sitting at the table, and suddenly she got thrown back like the chair fell over.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean it was like whoa, I'm always like I don't doubt these things. You know what I mean? I don't want to say but you have to wait to see. And then it was a knock on the door, pretty loud knock.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to the door, within 10 seconds, and opened the door, and it's a long hallway, and there was nobody there.
Wow. And from that was the day that made you a believer. You were somewhat of a skeptic. That happened. Yeah. You're like, all right.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know what I mean? I don't doubt these things. It's just because we don't understand them doesn't mean that they don't exist. We're probably only using like, 10% of our brains or something like that.
That's how I feel about women's vagina. Just because I don't understand them doesn't mean they don't exist.
It's kind of...
All right.
If you see the rubber dope he does, he's like, as a someone who has a huge vocabulary, I appreciate you and not dumbing down and working at the lowest common denominator. Pussy's pretty cool, right?
I follow me everywhere at I Am Ralph Sutton. My other podcast on health and wellness comes out every Monday called Good Sugar Podcast. We're opening up our first location on 3rd Avenue and 69th Street in 2 months. Good Sugar, the store will be opening. And I'm hosting July 30th at the Paramount Theater, Stone Temple Pilots, King's X, Steven Adler, and ZO2 for a foundation for the ZO2 David Foundation. I'll be hosting that event July 30th in Long Island. Mr. Steven Van Zandt, we end every show with a song, a playlist song. We add it to the strshow.com/playlist. We're going to let you pick, man. What do you want to hear? Whatever you want to hear.
Oh, my God. Anything?
Anything. As long as it's on Spotify, because we add it to the Spotify playlist, so don't go too deep.
So no Neil Young.
I mean, what?
No, Neil Young.
One of my songs?
Whatever you want. Whatever comes to mind. One of your songs, something off of Summer Sorcery, whatever the fuck. It doesn't matter.
Well, let's do something from Paul McCartney to celebrate his birthday this week. Let's do We Can Work It Out.
Okay, great. So, Steven Van Zandt, I cannot thank you enough. An honor to have you on the show. And we'll see everyone next time on the SDR Show. Peace.
You will have to keep on talking till I can go on. Why do you see it your way? Run a risk of knowing that our love may soon be gone. We can work it out. We can work it out. Think of what you say. You can get it wrong and still you think that it's all right.
You've been listening to the SDR Show.